Hello and welcome to The Future is Spoken, produced by the Digital Assistant Academy. This show accompanies the Digital Assistant Academy's course entitled Voice Interaction Design. Designing voice experiences for the elderly population comes with a lot of challenges or unique opportunities. In today's episode, Shyamala Praga speaks with Ryan Elza about voice design strategy for the elderly population. Ryan Elza is Vice President of Innovation and Technology at Volunteers of America National Services. Before that, Ryan was Social Entrepreneurship and Residence for Social Connectedness at AARP Foundation and led AARP Foundation's social isolation and digital inclusion work. He has an extensive background in the social determinants of health, design thinking, and civic engagement. He is a recognized subject matter expert on social isolation and voice-first design for older adults and has been at the frontier of developing voice-first solutions for low-income older adults. Ryan is a trained anthropologist and has a master's degree in technology entrepreneurship from the University of Maryland and is an avid mentor to students and startups at various stages of development. Prior to joining AARP Foundation, Ryan served as the program management specialist and adjunct professor for the national award-winning Honors College Entrepreneurship and Innovation Program at the University of Maryland. During his tenure with EIP, Ryan developed and launched several new entrepreneurial programs and initiatives, including the EIP Terp Tank Startup Competition and the Global Entrepreneurship Semester Program. Previously, he worked at the advisory board company on the performance technology team helping health systems implement transformational solutions. Mr. Elza was a social entrepreneur by the practice during his undergraduate career at the University of Maryland, where he founded and scaled the UMD chapter of Health Leads, a nonprofit that trained and placed students in primary care clinics as family advocates for low-income families to find resources such as food, housing, and job training. During his tenure, he worked with hospital administrators, primary care physicians, university administrators, and student volunteers to implement a closed-loop screening and referral system for the social determinants of health. Enjoy the show.
Welcome, Ryan.
Thank you so much for having me. I'm really looking forward to the conversation today.
I'm super excited myself, you know, especially given your background. I'm sure, you know, it will be an interesting conversation. So why don't you tell us about your background?
Yeah, I'm happy to give a little bit about my background and also about AARP Foundation. So I've been in social enterprise for over a decade now, really looking at how, you know, technology can be used to create really impactful change in community that's evidence-based and data-driven. So my career originally started actually helping to connect low-income families with appropriate resources within their community and integrating that into medical records in a clinical setting. So really looking at how you can create a closed-loop referral system for the social determinants of health. And then, you know, from there, I went into healthcare consulting for a little bit, went into teaching entrepreneurship and innovation at the University of Maryland, and leading the Honors College Entrepreneurship and Innovation Program, really helping to create curriculum and programs to equip students with the skill sets and tools to create their own social enterprises and tackle some big intractable problems before coming to AARP Foundation, where I'm currently at, and I serve as the Social Entrepreneur in Residence for Social Connectedness. So I lead AARP Foundation's work to address and end social isolation and loneliness for low-income older adults. So AARP Foundation is the charitable nonprofit affiliate of AARP. So most people are really familiar with AARP, it being the largest membership-based organization focused on older adult issues of about 38 million members across the country. So it's a really large, impactful organization. And then the foundation specifically focuses on how we can help in community address the needs of low-income older adult individuals, and we serve members and non-members alike around two main pillars: building economic opportunity and social connectedness. So in my role and capacity at the foundation, I'm really tasked with developing scalable solutions, leveraging technology in order to help connect older adults with their loved ones, their family members, and the community around them in order to live their best lives.
Interesting. You have a very interesting career journey for sure. And quite different than, you know, others I've been talking with. So I spoke with a lot of linguists. I spoke with a lot of people who come from psychology background or people, you know, who are into tech background. But yours is a completely different. You come from entrepreneurship as your specialty, which is interesting, right? And then here at AARP, you mentioned you work on senior communities, technologies and adoption kind of things. So could you talk a little bit more about that?
Yeah, happy to. So I started on my voice journey about 4 years ago when I joined AARP Foundation. And so one of the first projects that I worked on and really focused in on was understanding how we could leverage the up and coming power of voice first technologies to help address social isolation for older adults. And so, you know, 4 years ago, although it doesn't seem that long ago, was really a nascent time for voice first, you know, technology, smart speakers. We hadn't seen really widespread adoption. And so it was really bold for the foundation to kind of look into how this technology and natural language processing can be used. We had the initial hypothesis that, you know, voice first provided a easier to use interface for our population. So the communities that we work with, when we think about low-income older adults, people who are over the age of 50 and at the other at upper ends of the age spectrum as well, often haven't had access to the internet, haven't had access to any type of smart technology. So we encounter a lot of barriers when we think about creating digital solutions for them. And so the first and foremost things that we have to think about are how do you get access to those communities? And then how do you build confidence within them for them to be able to use the technologies in their everyday life? Because, you know, as an older person looks at technology and really tries to understand how they can leverage it, it can be a rather intimidating thing to, you know, take up a smart device for the first time in your entire life. And so we really thought that voice had that opportunity to be the bridge and the catalyst for older adults to adopt voice technology. And so, you know, in the early days, what we did in order to validate some of our assumptions and really learn about how voice could be leveraged is deployed 200 Amazon Echo devices across 5 senior housing communities in Baltimore and DC. And for that first initial period, we really looked at it as an opportunity to learn directly from older adults and really co-create with them as a part of that journey. And so, you know, I personally hosted over, you know, 30 focus groups across these properties, really just first understanding, were older adults using the devices? What were they using it for? What opportunities did they see for the technology? And then where could we find shared value in their communities in order to facilitate social connection? And so through that process, we really learned and validated, one, that older adults absolutely love to use voice technology. And so we saw a 90% adoption rate immediately from people that were participating in that initial pilot. And folks really found it an empowering technology that allowed them to take control of their lives and put themselves back into the driver's seat as they thought about maintaining their independence and really thinking about what was the realm of possibility in using technology. And so some of the first kind of use cases and most popular we heard, which I'm sure is no surprise to anyone who's kind of listening into this podcast, because it's kind of the number one things I use my smart speaker for, a voice assistant, is the ability to listen to music. So that is just for an individual who, as they are transitioning from one living setting into another, may have to give up several things as they're transitioning from a home or downsizing into an apartment. It may be their record collections, it may be their CDs. So the ability to actually listen to your own music and give a voice command and have this device play it for you at a whim was just something that was really magical. And you could see the spark and the light for individuals. And then the ability to set reminders is something really powerful for individuals. And so I know, you know, even at my age, and as I think about structuring my time, I can often forget about different appointments. And luckily I have my calendar and my Apple Watch personally, that's always giving me notifications about what's going on. But for folks who don't have smartphones, you know, don't have any type of digital calendar, that ability to set reminders for the medications, for their doctor's appointments and other types of engagements was something that was really helpful for them as they were using the technology. And then, you know, as I said before, I mean, these folks, for the most part, had never used smart devices, had never had access to the internet. So the ability to pose questions, get on-demand access to information was something that was really impactful, especially as folks had previously had to lean on their family members in order to gain access to information and ask them questions. And, you know, people talked about they felt really, as I said before, empowered, but also had some of the shame removed in having to ask a family member a question or asking them to search for information or make a connection. So kind of transitioning that ability to gain information and access it into their own hands was something that was really important to them as well as they were using the devices. And so from that initial pilot, you know, we kind of had validated all of the assumptions that we wanted to throughout the course of that. And it really showed to us that there was a promise in voice and that we should invest in it. And so for the past 4 years, we've built out a suite of voice first solutions for both affordable housing communities and affordable senior housing, independent living properties and apartments to connect residents with activities and information in those communities. And also a number of, you know, direct consumer voice products as well, focused on social isolation.
Wow, what a great story. You know, you started with validating the idea, first of all, with a couple of focus groups, and then identified that this could be something, you know, people will use. And from there, you actually, you know, designed it, which is kind of great. So it's more like market validation was done first to understand whether these people will use it. So what were the other motivations, you know, which you identified? Like, why was the adoption rate 90% all of a sudden? Was it just because of the tech barrier with other technologies, or were there any more use cases which were driving these adoptions?
Yeah, no, that's a really great question. And I'd say, so first and foremost, it was those primary use cases that we discussed, but there were other areas in which individuals were really leveraging the technology. So access to health-related information was really important. And so we saw that individuals were using it to access the WebMD skill and ask specific questions about their medication, side effects, symptoms, about medical conditions. And the really great inspiring thing is they were actually taking that information and taking it to their primary care physician or their doctor and using it to inform their care. We also saw that hands-free calling and messaging was really, you know, something that was powerful, especially when we think about older adults who, in the settings that we were working in, primarily live alone and, you know, are often concerned about their own safety. The ability to actually call a family member if they were to ever experience a fall or a medical situation provided some level of comfort and made them felt more comfortable living at home and on their own. And then we also, you know, the entertainment of the device too. So the ability to play games was something that was really fun. Everyone loves to play Jeopardy. You know, that's probably one of the very first game and skills or actions that people will use the device for. My personal favorite game, which I encourage folks to do, is, because I'm a big NPR nerd, is Wait, Don't Tell Me, and their voice quiz skill. But the ability to access all forms of media entertainment too. So the radio station, it's really fun to see someone who may be living in Baltimore now, but had grew up in New York and is able to access their hometown radio station, right? And they never really thought that was a possibility before, but just being able to ask their smart device for that hometown station and tap into that nostalgia and into a community that they may have moved away from is something that I think is also kind of important and critical. Because as we age, so many things in our lives are stripped away from us. And I think it all goes back into really giving people the ability to reclaim some part of life that they may have lost through the power of technology. And I think at the core of it, that's what we really saw that was driving a lot of the adoption.
So if I understand correctly, it's more like, you know, they were able to find some sort of companion or, you know, like some sort of guardian with these assistants, because now these assistants, you know, started reminding them about medicines or, you know, certain things which they may not want their family members to actually, you know, like help around, especially. So because, yeah, they still want to make sure that they are independent, because I can understand how my father was. Of course, you know, like he would not agree to a couple of things, like he's aging, first of all. And the other thing that, yes, he has started having hearing losses and the ability to walk and all of those things. So definitely, you know, like they lose self-confidence the moment, you know, like if they have to still depend on someone. And I feel like voice assistants have given them more power with all of these things. So if I understand correctly, that's what, you know, like it's done to them.
Yeah. Absolutely. And I want to key on one thing that you mentioned there in terms of the companionship, because that is one thing that we actually found through the course of our work that we were a little bit surprised about. It was how much older adults humanized and viewed the smart assistant as a member of their family, of their life. We had so many people, you know, consistently say to us, and again, you have to think about, you know, these individuals who are living alone. They might be socializing outside the apartment, but when they come home, they are alone. And that can be something really difficult that you deal with as you age, especially if you've had a spouse and you've lost them and now you're living alone independently. You know, people consistently told us that the first thing that they do in the morning is to say, "Good morning, Alexa." And the last thing that they did before going to bed was saying goodnight to her. And just hearing another voice in the room in their apartment made them feel less alone, which was something that, you know, we always use technology as a catalyst for human connection, but to understand how that voice assistant could also be a pseudo companion and remediate some of those feelings of loneliness was something definitely intriguing. And I think also presents a lot of potential in the future as we think about, you know, really increasing the capabilities of voice assistants in our everyday lives. And then the other thing I'll just kind of say to that, just kind of the fun and quirkiness of the personalities that are built into some of the voice assistants, you know, made people laugh and smile. And so the ability to tell jokes or to get, you know, witty responses back too, I think adds a dynamic that people really enjoy and makes it feel a little bit more personal.
So this brings me to a very interesting point. You know, with the personality and all of these things comes its own challenges, right? Like if we overdo the personality, there could be consequences for that as well. So first of all, did these elderly population understand that they are talking to a bot or a machine and not a human on the other side?
Yes. And they did. And that was also, I mean, part of the what happened within the focus groups is it also became a support group for technology and sharing funny exchanges about interactions in which, you know, an invocation or a question went wrong and they got wacky responses, right? And that group actually built resilience in using technology. So as folks were encountering those issues, you know, especially as we think of the population that hasn't historically used technology, they don't have the troubleshooting skills that people who are digital natives have. So understanding that something that they're doing or communicating to that device might not be their fault. They're not receiving the intended result from their questions or commands, that inherently the technology is evolving, adapting over time and is flawed and continually improving. Because I think, you know, some of the fear that we heard for people who were really a little reticent to use it at first was, you know, they were afraid they were going to break it. They were going to break the technology. But that's a really great thing about voice, right? Is like you may get the wrong answer or the wrong action from how your question, but you're never going to break it and you can always come back to it. And also there's no judgment involved like as you're going through that journey together, because it's just you and the device going back and forth.
So it's more like trial and error with them, right? I mean, I still remember when I gifted my mom Alexa, you know, she was very hesitant for the very same reason, like she'll break it. And then she was very scared because initially she didn't know what to ask, how to ask. And she was all over the place with it. So I had to tell her, like, this is how you have to. And then once she got a little comfortable, now it's like her companion all the time, you know, like for everything. So I feel like it's the initial, you know, like inhibitions with these elderly population before they actually get used to it.
Yeah, absolutely. And I think, you know, kind of working alongside them in the process and the setup, setting up the devices and giving examples and kind of giving them cues on how they can use it and those use cases and those high value use cases is something that definitely increases adoption. And so what we took from our initial pilot, once we had outlined all of the top uses that folks were using it for, we actually translated that into a training curriculum and content so that as we developed the program, we could package that up and give it to new consumers so that they would kind of overcome those initial inhibitions and be able to deliver some value or personal connection that would get them to use the technology.
That's kind of smart because I feel it's solving two problems at once. One is, you know, like training them what to do and how to do. So, you know, like taking away that initial fear. But what it also did was maybe, you know, it's solving the discoverability problem, because now you are telling them, oh, these are the few things, you know, which is possible through the assistant. So now they know what to do, you know, and how to find it.
Yeah, absolutely.
Yeah, great. So did you find like designing for seniors was, you know, different? Now you might have, you know, like seen the other assistants are now all there, but what kind of challenges or, you know, like differences did you identify when you were designing, like when you were interacting with these seniors, doing research with them or testing it out or any such things? What other, you know, like differences did you identify?
Yeah, no, those are excellent questions. And I would say, you know, first and foremost, the ability of an individual to, you know, follow the voice assistant and have the attention span for information that's being communicated, making sure that it's communicated in a speed and rhythm that is compatible with their ability to process information. So, you know, some of the first initial trials as we were going out there, you know, that one of the very first things that we heard is that, you know, Alexa is speaking too quickly, speaking too fast. I'm unable to, you know, kind of catch all of the information that's being delivered to me. So really thinking thoughtfully about, as you're designing interactions, one, the speed of the what's being communicated back to individuals, but also the amount of information, making sure it's really digestible, short iterations and bursts, and that has really clear guidance and instructions for individuals. You know, since there is no visual user interface, you know, the ability for someone to kind of understand what the universe of options or how they can respond is much more limited. And for folks who don't have that exposure into technology, you have to be a little bit more prescriptive in your design. So really creating a path that is kind of expected, and you can kind of key up any type of interaction that is going to come in between, you know, prompts and commands and some of those considerations. So those were kind of the very first things that we discovered in that process that really helped to drive adoption. But I think, you know, one thing that was really enlightening for us is, you know, in those early days of skills and actions that were going into the marketplaces that were focused on older dots, what we found is, you know, a lot of these were focused on caregiving dynamics and situations. And they're really more designed from the perspective of, oh, I know my mom, I know my dad, here's a pain point that we're experiencing in our relationship and our dynamic, but it didn't include the older adult's perspective and what they wanted to do through the device and how they would, you know, how would they think about creating commands or invocations and some of those items. And so I think the thing that we learned, which I think, you know, everyone tries to teach as, you know, is really making sure you're co-creating with your customers and users, but it's even more extremely important for older adults because their perspective can be vastly different than other generations and people who are digital natives. It's a completely different dynamic in view.
Totally. Yeah. I can see that happening because, you know, we are not them. So we don't know what challenges they are facing. Right. So you mentioned it was voice first only. Now, with age comes a lot of challenges like memory or physical limitations, or sometimes, you know, like it could be anything else, right? Too many things can happen. Like my dad started having hearing problems, you know, as he was starting to age, and he would never agree to that, though. That was a different story. And he never wanted hearing aids because he felt like the moment I have the hearing aids, you know, like I'm giving up on my age. Mm-hmm. So they don't want to do these kind of things. But then with voice first only, now you, when we are designing something, how about people who started having issues, age-related issues like memory issues or hearing issues and all? Did you find like, you know, voice first was not the solution for that, and there was always a need to have a screen to accommodate or help these users?
That's a really great question. I think as we think about different types of technologies and matching them based on abilities and interests of individuals, it's really important to take that into consideration. So voice first is really powerful, but it's not a panacea technology for older adults because of some of the limitations that you mentioned. You know, we did encounter, you know, some of these issues throughout the course. I think memory is always, you know, something that is at play when you're thinking about older adults and cognition, and even myself, right? It's when you don't have that kind of visual interface or cue to kind of understand you know, what you're intended to do or how you can leverage a technology or a tool. It just, you have your moments in which you can completely blank on, wait, what am I supposed to say again? So if you don't have that kind of broad, you know, level of ability to interpret, you know, a universe of commands that could come to it, it can be really difficult. So one thing that we did for to help empower individuals to be able to use the voice first solutions that we built on Alexa and Google Action was to create, you know, helpful guides and palm cards and, you know, posters that they can put in their room to remind them about different commands and prompts, the invocation name, to be able to use it. Because, you know, sometimes you know, from the user perspective, you should be able to ask the device a question and get, you know, the intended response that you're trying to. So one of our applications, Community Hub, allows individuals to access their properties, community calendar of events and activities, right? And so they want it to be a first level intent in which they can say, hey, what's on the calendar today? But, you know, it's making sure that you have trained them properly at the outset and have the, you know, material that can remind them, like, no, you have to have the, you know, skill name in the command in order to be able to access that calendar. Eventually, we'll get to that place where, you know, the devices or smart, the voice assistants will be smart enough that they'll be able to kind of interpret what the first level intent is, but you know, we're turning the corner on that. But that's definitely something that is a barrier currently for older adults in kind of fully maximizing the use of third-party skills and applications on Alexa and Google. In terms of, you know, using screen devices or even having, like, when I think about low-income older adults in populations who might not have access to a smart device with a screen, you know, the ability to do any type of level of account linking in some of those components become increasingly difficult, and also take a higher level of digital literacy to be able to do that. And so we used voice using individuals' phone numbers to do account association and account linking, because we're like, okay, what's a unique identifier that we could use through a voice experience that we're confident our individuals will know, but is unique enough that we'll be able to match them up if we have it in the database of, you know, users on the back end of our solution in order to appropriately place them into the correct property. And we came to the conclusion, well, everyone knows their phone number. So we use that as an opportunity to do that. But, you know, there are some assistive technologies that can be used with smart assistants. So the ability to, you know, do Bluetooth pairing or having devices that allow you to hear the voice assistant through a hearing aid or a hearable, or having some of the Amazon devices in which, if you have a really soft voice, right, that's another area where older adults their voices can weaken over time. So it takes more energy and effort for those individuals to try to invoke a smart speaker. So having the tap devices in which you can actually speak into a remote or other assistive technology is something that can, you know, increase the ability of individuals to use these types of technologies and not be left behind.
Totally. Yeah. I mean, these are all great points. And I feel like when it comes to simplifying some of those things, maybe we are still not there, but I think the technology is constantly trying to improve day in and day out to do that, right? Now, there are additional things when it comes to designing for elderly, for example, which I'm thinking about. For concentration, like, it's very difficult for even me to concentrate or, you know, like, focus on something for a long period of time. And sometimes if these voice assistants are talking forever, sometimes they mm-hmm. do, right? So then I may completely get lost. So even if that is a problem with, you know, mid-age person, that will be a bigger problem for older age as well. So how did you think about solving for these kind of problems, like focusing on concentration or memories in general? You know, like, did you find, like you mentioned, you simplified some of those, or mm-hmm. you broke the utterances or the responses and all of those things, right? Mm-hmm. Were there any other things which you identified outside of these, which really helps when designing for elderly?
Yeah, I think being able to shorten the prompts and utterances is something, you know, that helps mediate some of those issues. you know, one thing that we found is if you are having an interaction that is going on for too long of a period of time, they will try to interrupt. Or if they can, if they think they can preempt what the question is going to be, they'll try to answer in advance. But that doesn't work until the listening window is open, right? So you have to kind of think and design around some of those considerations. And then making sure, because of the concentration and focus, and sometimes it takes an older adult a little bit longer to respond, making sure that the listening window is long enough that the session is not going to time out. Because if it times out, then they're going to get frustrated and they might be, you know, put back into a loop experience. And, you know, one thing that is immediately clear in designing for this population is, you know, you have a, maybe not just one shot, maybe you have two shots, but you have a limited number of opportunities to provide the value of the solution that you built. And if there is a lot of friction or they experience pain points in the first time that they're using it, they're not going to come back to it. That is just kind of immediately clear. They're just going to write it off as this doesn't work and move on.
Yeah, totally. I feel like maybe they have limited patience when it comes to technology. They'll try a couple of times. If it did not work, they'll not even attempt to try it again. They're like, okay, forget it. It never works, right? And which is kind of normal with most of the people. But do you see, you know, there are issues related to self-isolation. So now it's a problem with everyone. Many people are stuck at home, right? They are alone and they have no companion, no one to talk with. And that has led to more problems of self-isolation, which is you have to social distance. But at the same time, you know, because you have no one to talk to or no one is meeting with you, you know, there are issues with depressions or such things where, you know, mental health comes into play. So how do you think when you're thinking about designing the voice strategies to solve for these kind of problems?
Yeah, that's a really excellent question. And you know, one that we're actively, you know, trying to build in design solutions as a part of our work. And I would say, you know, as we think about voice and technology, as I mentioned earlier, we really do view it as a catalyst for human connection. And it's just in large part is providing education and content for individuals to understand, you know, at a fundamental level, one, how can they think about their own social isolation, their own conditions? What are some barriers in place that might be preventing them to connect with individuals? How can you think about educating them to creating problem-solving frameworks in order to overcome those barriers? And then how can you be prescriptive about how the technology can be used in order to facilitate that connection, whether it's hands-free calling or messaging and some of those capabilities? But one voice application that we launched this year is called Social Check-In. So that is a social isolation self-assessment that individuals can take through their smart speaker and their voice assistant live on both Amazon Alexa and Google Action. And so through that experience, we educate individuals about what is social isolation, what is social connection, and the importance of those topics and the related health impacts of those on an individual's life. And then we walk them through that assessment and provide them a level of risk that they may have for social isolation. And in that experience, they're invited to provide their phone number if they want to receive a link to more in-depth results based on their assessment. And so if they provide their phone number, we text them a link that goes to our connecttoeffect.org, which is our social isolation awareness platform. And individuals can, you know, find additional resources and content available there in order to find resources, services in their local community, and tips and tricks about being more connected. So we've really taken it, you know, from the lens of awareness to education to action to hopefully be able to help better connect individuals.
That's an amazing initiative for sure. It's going to help a lot, especially in this world we are living post-pandemic, for sure. So now when you're talking about everything connected and you know all these devices, there are issues with privacy, there are issues with, you know, like systems getting hacked and such kind of things. How do you think about handling, you know, like safety when it comes to people who are living alone and elderly population are more prone to such hacks? because they are not tech savvy as much, right? So what kind of strategies are you guys thinking about?
Yeah, a great question there. And so we think about it from an education perspective again. So we have developed curriculum and training to help individuals understand the privacy settings on their device, understand, you know, how they can take proactive steps in order to protect their privacy, their confidential information, you know, to protect against, you know, third party individuals coming into their home, you know, using their assistant or getting access to account information, and how they should proactively protect that information. You know, AARP actually has a really robust fraud network that we offer at the enterprise level. So we have a hotline in which individuals, if they feel like they're experiencing fraud or any types of scams, are able to call in, ask questions about it, and get advice and recommendations. And we also put out a lot of content, a lot of education about what are the top, you know, phishing campaigns that are currently being run. What are those campaigns that are focused on older adults? You know, how their, you know, individuals are trying to, you know, be scammed related to Medicare and you know, healthcare and a lot of, you know, Social Security, a lot of these key focus areas, and how to identify what are those red flags of suspicious situations. So first and foremost, we look at it from an education perspective. And then, you know, also making sure that there's the technical assistance available for individuals to ask questions.
Yeah, that is definitely super helpful for anyone, not only elderly population, but if we are able to get the same kind of strategies for even normal population, it would help our underserved population to make it more inclusive. So that's a great point. So what I'm understanding is it's been mostly focused on education, like educating the users, their rights, their choices, and what they can do, what they cannot, and their risks and all of those things. So it's more being transparent about, you know, like your solution and being clear and open about things, what they should and shouldn't be doing.
Yeah, absolutely. Especially as a part of our work, you know, everything that we're doing in our programs are evidence-based. So we're actually trying to prove that we're moving the needle on social isolation in communities. And so as a part of that, we do assessments with users in order to actually take baseline and follow-up assessments on their level of social connection. And we have, you know, as a part of that, you know, we believe fully in the transparency and also informed consent. So really making sure that individuals understand what data is being collected, how it's being used, and, you know, the some of the items and cautions around that as well.
Yeah, I think those are really like topic of the need for sure. And given that, you know, there are so many voice assistants out there and all sorts of news we are hearing about they getting hacked or they listening into what we are saying and all of those things for sure. So you did mention that, you know, you also have a healthcare skill or something to help them out, like a WebMD or things like that, right? Are there anything else outside of those which you're focusing on when it comes to elderly health or elderly well-being?
So we, and the skill I mentioned earlier actually is WebMD's, their own, you know, third-party skill, not affiliated with ours. You know, we have produced our social check-in, as I mentioned earlier, focused on, you know, screening and education around social isolation in our community hub, which is a solution for both individuals within affordable housing settings, independent living settings, and the providers of those communities to actually create and facilitate interactions and engagements between staff and the residents within those properties. And this year, we're really looking across, you know, our landscape to understand what are new and potential use cases for voice to help connect individuals to resources, to potentially to education around workforce issues and opportunities, especially in a time in which a lot of individuals are experiencing, you know, unemployment, and understanding how we can provide content education to help them get back into a position of employment. And then also thinking about how we can help them increase access to different benefits and services. So how could a voice assistant help them navigate what types of services they might pre-qualify for based on, you know, individual characteristics? And then how could you leverage that assistant to help complete the first stages of applications to benefits, and then have those benefits be completed offline? So those are some of the things we're exploring right now. kind of build on our current success in adoption of our tools.
Wow, yeah. So see, there are some additional things also, right? When it comes to aging, mm-hmm. you know, there could be people who have dementia or people who have, you know, any physical limitations and things like that as well. So sometimes I may even forget what to say or what wake up what to say, or I have to press a push to talk button to talk, right? If mm-hmm. I'm dealing with that, or maybe it's too far and not approachable to me because I have mobility issues now. So have you thought about solutions around, you know, wearables and other things to enable? And how did you think about solving for people who have dementia and all?
Yeah, so as an organization, you know, AARP is really focused on education around dementia and equipping caregivers, you know, with best practices and helping them to navigate those situations. AARP Foundation as an organization, we don't focus in specifically on dementia. And so that's definitely a ripe opportunity and space for, I think, innovation to happen out there in the field and thinking about, you know, what are the IoT solutions, you know, whether it's, you know, connecting wearables or other types of sensors within the home to create a comprehensive solution in order to be able to equip people who are on that journey with tools for independence, but also their loved ones, or even thinking about what are the other stakeholders that may be involved. So thinking about higher level of care settings, nursing homes, assisted livings, and staff within those facilities, how they might be able to leverage the technology to better, you know, direct care to individuals. So I think it's definitely a ripe area for exploration, but it's not one that the foundation is investing in.
So if anyone wants to start thinking about designing for elderly population, what would you suggest? Where should they start?
Well, I would recommend, you know, finding an older adult within their life and, you know, engage them in that conversation. If they have an idea, you know, get their feedback and opinion on it first and really try to get some market validation for the direction that they're heading before doing anything. And then, you know, really look at it from a lean design perspective and think about, as they're coming up with potential ideas and solutions, how they can, you know, mock up, you know, Wizard of Oz effect an interaction in order to, again, validate that idea before even, you know, coding anything or putting anything into production. I think starting from that place first, you're going to get further along down the road once you've kind of identified, you know, what the value proposition is and the problem that you're trying to solve. And that all starts with the user that you're working with. And so go out and, you know, talk to your grandmother, talk to your grandfather, your mom, your dad, whoever it may be. Go volunteer at a local nursing home, senior center. Observe, understand what, you know, they're trying to find solutions for, and then build from that place. And then, you know, bring them along with you at every step of the journey and make sure that they have an active role and that they are an equal member of the team as you're going along and creating something.
That's a great suggestion. And actually, I'm curious to do that more now. So I'll definitely try that as well. So where can people find more about you, Ryan?
Yeah, well, folks can learn more about AARP Foundation at aarpfoundation.org, or more about some of our Voice First solutions at connectedcommunities.aarpfoundation.org. And if folks would like to reach out to me or learn more about me as a person and some of my experiences, feel free to search for me on LinkedIn, and I'm happy to connect.
Thank you so much. We'll make sure we add all of this in our show notes. Thank you for your time. It has been a pleasure talking with you today.
Yeah, thank you for the opportunity and highlighting, you know, a population that, you know, there's a lot of potential and opportunity. And so I appreciate the time.
Absolutely. I think this is a very important topic for sure.
Yeah, and it's only a growing market.
Can't deny. Thank you.
Thanks for listening today. Like to post a voice comment, please go to www.witlingo.com/DAA. That's www.witlingo.com/DAA. We'd love to hear from you. Remember, you can find all the information on becoming a certified voice interaction designer and show notes and more at our website at digitalassistant.academy. That's digitalassistant.academy. We encourage your feedback and questions. Be sure to get in touch by using the Digital Assistant Academy's website. We will include the show notes link. In our next episode, Ramita Bulchandani speaks with us about designing for empathy in conversation design. Until next week, take care.